You are listening to WRIR 97.3 LPFM, and this is Open Source RVA. Open Source RVA is WRIR's weekly news digest. Today, we'll be talking about Richmond's uncertain status as a bike-friendly city, lift the lid on the new proposed ballpark in Chaco Bottom, and present the first in a two-part segment on the growing fight over the city's water rates. Here are some of the top stories making headlines right now.
For Open Source RVA, I'm Amy Daniel, and here's the news. Richmond's 9th District will have someone to vote for in this November school board race. Teachy Pinckney Epps, who had filed far more than the required 125 signatures needed to have her name on the ballot, had been denied certification as a candidate by the Richmond Voter Registrar after the registrar determined that more than 50 of those signatures were invalid. Apparently, the U.S. District Court Judge Henry Hudson did not agree. And based on Pinckney Epps' lawsuit, the registrar finally saw the light. Yesterday, Hudson issued an order restoring Ms. Epps to the ballot. Governor Bob McDonnell's K-12 Education Reform Summit came to town this week. The Virginia Chamber of Commerce hosted, and Delegate Kirk Cox and James W. Dyke Jr. co-chaired. In addition to his recent service on the mayor's nonpartisan education task force, Dyke made his living as a registered lobbyist as recently as 2011, when he was on the payroll of the for-profit University of Phoenix, as well as the financially struggling Edison Schools Incorporated. Unlike last year's summit, this year's registration cost $250 for the public, a steep paywall for parents and teachers. When asked about the high price, the governor's press secretary, Jeff Caldwell, told Open Source RVA that expenses to host the conference made registration fees necessary to help defray costs. Caldwell did not address whether the cost might discourage attendance by two of the key groups most affected by education policy. In spite of mounting public concern and criticism about the safety of nuclear power, Dominion Virginia Power has plans to spend millions to bring its North Anna plant up to snuff to face the next earthquake or other natural disaster, the Times-Dispatch reported this week. The decision to spend as much as $40 million on the plant upgrades comes about a year after a 5.8 magnitude quake struck central Virginia. That quake shut down the North Anna plant for 3 months while engineers checked for damage. In his effort to tame Richmond School Board's budget overruns, Mayor Dwight C. Jones is using Richmond jail inmates to do maintenance work at Richmond schools. The matter was first reported today by Richmond Magazine, which received an anonymous tip about prisoners doing grounds maintenance at George Mason Elementary School in Church Hill. Officials with Richmond's Department of Public Works have confirmed that inmates were being used on maintenance projects at schools and defended the practice as being perfectly legal. And according to state code, it is legal, but this doesn't stop the Richmond school officials from having some significant concerns about the practice. School spokeswoman Felicia Cosby says the district will be speaking to the city about its use of inmates on school-based projects.
Just when you thought it was safe to park on West Broad Street between Pine and Boulevard, city police put up flyers this week announcing the enforcement of a new no-parking time of between 2 and 6 a.m. Well, this came as a bit of a shock to the West Grace Street Association and area business owners, who've been lobbying to have the area's no-parking signs completely removed. Second District City Councilman Charles Samuels was also surprised by the announcement. In an email statement obtained by Open Source RVA, Samuels expressed disappointment in the police action and says that he is going to require that the police provide statistics and facts to support any public service claim. Back in June, the owner of the Camel nightclub, Rand Burgess, was arrested and sentenced to 30 hours of community service after he attempted to warn his customers that they needed to move their cars because of the police's aggressive enforcement of the no parking signs near the nightclub. He told Open Source RVA that the West Gray Street Association is not accepting this as a solution, and neither are the businesses. This whole controversy surrounding West Broad Street parking looks like it's going to go before City Council at the September 8th Council meeting.
Back in March 2004, the Commonwealth Transportation Board adopted its plan to integrate bike and pedestrian pathways into Virginia's roads. That plan began with the surprising assumption that all state road projects must include bike lanes and sidewalks. Fast forward to 2012. The new Huguenot Bridge with its broad shoulders is one result of VDOT's extensive efforts to live up to its mandate, but it's a bridge to nowhere for cyclists. Drama still plays out daily on Richmond's roads, which include only about 8 miles of designated bike lanes. Sometimes those dramas end in tragedy. Daniel Pritchett is a cyclist and motorist. He also was the boyfriend of Lainey Krzyzewski, an experienced cyclist who died July 29th while riding on River Road, not far from the Huguenot Bridge. Despite his own loss, Daniel remains hopeful about the ability of motorists and cyclists to coexist.
Cyclists and motorists do share roads, and the motorists need to be aware that people on bicycles are, bicycles are vehicles as well.
As more cyclists take to Richmond's roads, learning mutual respect becomes ever more important.
You're talking about matters of life and death, and public safety.
In 2015, Richmond plays host to the UCI Road World Championship, a major international bike competition expected to draw hundreds of thousands of cycling fans and bike enthusiasts to Richmond. And it seems likely that with more bikes on the road, more interaction with motorists will mean more potential for injuries and death. We're here with Jacob Humboldt. He's a pedestrian bike and trails coordinator for the city, and also Amy George. She's a member of the Mayor's Pedestrian Bike and Trails Commission and a board member of Ride Richmond. We're going to be talking a little bit about bikes, bike safety, and how Richmond is moving forward with its efforts to share its increasingly crowded roads. So let's start real quick with Amy. You've had some very good experiences, obviously, with bikes. You're mm-hmm. you're a daily rider.
Right.
But you've also had a couple of near misses yourself.
I have. I've been pretty lucky. I've been riding in Richmond about almost 10 years this summer, and I've only had two accidents. Maybe not surprisingly, they happened, you know, within the first couple of years I was here. The first one was the worst, and I was doored by a car right by VCU at Harrison and Carey Street, right in front of a fraternity house that was getting evicted. You know, other than some bruises and a lot of road rash, I was all right. You know, I was wearing a helmet. It was daytime. I didn't have any lights. I had some reflectors on my bike.
Well,
but
we were talking a little bit before the show. Whose fault was this?
Well, ultimately, it was the fault of the driver because he opened his door. It's up to him to make sure that, you know, that it's safe to open your door. So ultimately, it rests on the driver. I could have avoided the collision by being further to the left, but like I said, since I was preparing to make a right turn onto Harrison Street, I was over to the right more. So
you had a little bit of responsibility.
I could have avoided that crash.
But this is, I guess, it plays to sort of the constant push-pull between drivers and cyclists is who has right of way,
exactly.
Why are you on our roads? And really, roads are for everybody, right? Mm-hmm.
And in Virginia, bikes are required to follow the same rules as vehicles and also have the same rights as vehicles. So I like to say that bike safety is a two-way street, implying that bikes need to do their part, cyclists need to do their part to, you know, ride safely and predictably, and cars have a responsibility to pass within a safe distance and give us that, the space on the road that we deserve.
So what's lacking in the education? Is it on the cyclist side or is it on the motorist side?
Well, a lot of motorists really still believe that bikes are in their way. They see bikes as traffic rather than actually taking away, you know, a bike takes up so much less space than a car. You know, if we could replace 20 cars with 20 bikes, the traffic would be less on any given street. And so to be seen as an obstacle instead of an improvement in the traffic situation is really frustrating. And it also is on the cyclist that they need to ride, like I said, predictably, you know, out in the lane in such a position that they aren't weaving between the parking lane. Richmond has a lot of parking lanes that may or may not have parked cars. So if you're riding in the parking lane then swerving out into the traffic lane to go around a parked car and then swerving back in, you're not riding a predictable way. Same with if you were to be riding on the sidewalk, you're crossing streets at pedestrian crossings, you might be endangering pedestrians.
And real quick, we're here with Jacob Humboldt, pedestrian, bicycle, and trails coordinator for the city, and Amy George, who's a member of the Mayor's Pedestrian, Bicycle, and Trails Commission, and a board member of Ride Richmond, and wanted to ask, I guess, both of you, with your what you're doing with the city, where is policy going? What's being advised to the mayor to do, or I guess what you guys are trying to implement with regards to improving bike lanes or just improving bike safety.
Do you want to talk any about the process? Amy has been involved in the PBT commission process, so you might want to.
And that began with the mayor.
Right. Actually, arrived. 2 years ago on Bike to Work Day, the mayor declared that there would be this pedestrian, bicycle, and trails commission. There were two co-chairs named, and they began having monthly meetings. There were several subcommittees. There was a policy subcommittee, an infrastructure subcommittee, an education subcommittee. And these subcommittees basically were tasked with coming up with a set of recommendations. And that was the initial document that kind of, once Jake was hired and brought on, that this kind of formed the city's policy since the mayor and city council, you know, approved this document. And then he was able to take, you know, what the PBT as a whole kind of wanted to see based on some policy recommendations. We kind of came up with a loose network of and a prioritization of bike infrastructure, a mix of you know, bike lanes, shared lane markings or sharrows, and other infrastructure. And then he's been here for about a year and just working on getting that kind of low-hanging fruit, taking our first steps toward becoming a more bike-friendly city.
Okay. You know, and so how do we build, you know, how do we take all those things that have related elements and go about, you know, having this cogent approach that's
by 2015, are we going to look like Williamsburg with bike lanes everywhere? Or?
Well, I mean, we'll definitely have more infrastructure. What we want to make sure is that we do it right and, you know, just don't go about it in an ad hoc fashion. You know, bike lanes, you know, a lot of people say, oh, well, we need more bike lanes. And bike lanes are a tool in the toolbox. But bike lanes come with downsides as well in terms of, you know, the bike infrastructure in the U.S. is really going through a pretty quick learning curve here in just the last decade and even less than the last decade in terms of lessons learned and kind of rethinking how we design some of it. You know, bike lanes solve some problems but potentially introduce others, and so there's more guidance being developed in terms of how to do your best to design and engineering with that kind of stuff, because you know, a good example is the fact that when you are in a bike lane, you're potentially on the outside of a turning vehicle,
right?
You know, so that's completely contrary to your traditional engineering where, you know, you never have a through lane on the outside of a turn lane.
Right.
Same thing with the dooring issue. You know, the move is now to wider bike lanes or buffered bike lanes, so there's a more degree of separation between the car and the bike lane. Because,
okay,
you know,
I see.
If you're saying ride next to the car, and then we're telling people don't ride next to the car, you know, through education, mm-hmm. You know, they're at odds. So best practices are really starting to kind of filter out. So we want to make sure that what we're putting down on the ground is the best thought out.
What is a sharrow?
A sharrow is the common term for what's called a shared lane marking. That's the technical term. And so it's a chevron with a bike logo that's put on the roadway. And so you'll see them on Meadow and Harrison. Mm-hmm. We did those as kind of pilot installations. And we're going to be doing a lot more of those. And it's kind of this low-hanging fruit, for one. It's basically used where you don't have enough width to actually stripe in a separate designated bike lane.
Is something like that mainly trying to create awareness?
It does a few things. One is awareness. You know, this big, bright white stencil, you know, it's hard to miss. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like the Share the Road sign. But it's on the pavement, but much more effective than the Share the Road sign is they're placed in the lane in such a way that, and we need to do some education elements on this, but the placement of those sharrows is essentially about where you would want the bicyclist to ride. So we've actually been a little bit more liberal than the minimum standards in terms of placement, moving them a little bit farther away from the curb or farther away from the car door.
And that's been intentional. It's not.
Yes, because the intent is to help prevent wrong way riding. That's one of the things. But the big thing is better lane placement for the bicyclist farther into the lane.
Now, before we go, I do want to talk a little bit about that. One of the big things it seems like with that tension between motorists and cyclists, mm-hmm. is it's again, goes back to, I suppose, who's a cyclist, who's using this for transportation,
right.
who's using it for fun, and who's following the rules of the road. You often see cyclists riding wrong way. You'll
yep.
see them using the sidewalk. You see them skipping the red light. You see them doing all manner of things that are not things that cars are allowed to do. So you could, I guess, see where a motorist would lose respect or just become annoyed. Or how do you educate cyclists and what's available to, I guess, make this more of a standardized means of transportation?
Well, yeah. One of the things I like to point out is that Richmond, you know, was started centuries before cars or bikes were here. You know, our street grid was laid out with horse-drawn carriages in mind. So for cars to say, well, the roads were built for us, doesn't really apply in most urban neighborhoods in Richmond. So like what Jake was saying, the sharrows are a good solution because we have narrow streets, and that's what allows for, you know, our dense urban network. So for us, you know, to think that, like, bikes are a secondary concern to car traffic is kind of, you know, when you think about the larger picture of the city, that's not really how the city can work. So I feel that it's both on the cyclists to educate themselves and to just, I mean, we at Ride Richmond really try to just educate by example. We try to, you know, we demonstrate good riding technique using proper safety gear. One of our board members is teaching a VCU cycling class this year. You can take, you can get a one credit class at VCU for just learning the kind of best practices on urban cycling in Richmond.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's
schools
true.
Schools are definitely a great place to learn that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I was in the 4-H program when I was young, so mm-hmm. I actually got basically traffic skills 101
on a horse.
On a horse.
On a bicycle, even.
Is that one of the H's, horse, or is that a...
Absolutely. I forget what the other three are.
Hey. One of them is bicycle.
Hey, yeah.
Hey, H horse. Is for bicycle.
I don't know.
Yes. And so there's a definite need for, you know, cycling safety. You know, kids can... Part of the federal outreach is safe routes to school, and that's a big concern both for, you know, as far as obesity goes. You know, if kids are able to ride their bikes to school, that will help combat obesity. It actually, students are shown to perform better when they get exercise.
You get a little bit of blood going to the brain.
Exactly.
The morning,
so it'll save us money by not having to run so many buses in a
yeah.
time when schools are very cash strapped.
And improve standardized testing.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. That's a good argument.
So I think cycling safety and just like encouraging cycling in young people, elementary, middle, and high school, you know, will just help grow a new generation of well-educated cyclists.
Yeah. Well, and even, you know, there's the two points to add on to that is a Chesterfield police officer that I was speaking to at a Safe Routes to School event one time was kind of talking about how through middle schools, one of the ways you can kind of, one of the hooks to captivate and engage the kids, because, you know, it's nothing harder than to, you know,
make them care.
Make
them
want to do
saying,
something,
right.
You know, in middle school, is kind of pitch it to them as pre-driver's ed. You know, same road, same ride, same rules. You don't get to drive a car yet, but basically this is still a vehicle under the code, and so
mm-hmm.
everything still applies. And even if they don't become a cyclist or carry that on through life,
they're learning
they've
to
learned
drive.
It through the yeah, as part of, you know, their driving skills, and they understand mm-hmm. how that translates to when they're behind the wheel.
Well, yeah. Hopefully.
But in Richmond, I feel like that's really important because I think 25% of Richmonders have no car and 50% of Richmond households have only one car. So
yeah. 18% of households, so it's even more. So yeah,
yeah.
It's probably somewhere around 25%
yeah, there,
don't have a
there's
car.
There's a lot of opportunity for people to be riding. Richmond is like, if
it's,
you look at the
grid.
It's
ripe to become.
It's
right.
We have all this like pent up demand, and we just need to do, you know, follow our plan and start working towards making the city a bike-friendly,
right.
even more bike-friendly than yeah. we already are.
Yeah, right. We've got good bones and, you know, nice rideable infrastructure in terms of being, you know, a grid network and whatnot. But
so we're on our way.
Yeah.
We
yeah.
got both wheels on the ground. All right. Well, thank you to Jacob Helmbolt and to Amy George for coming in today to talk a little bit about bikes and bike safety and
take
bike
me out
stuff.
To the ball game.
Thank you very
sung
much.
By Edward Meeker, Edison Records.
You're listening to Open Source RVA on 97.3 WRIR. Baseball isn't so much big business in Richmond, but it certainly is a big deal. A few years back, a $350 million proposal to move Richmond's baseball stadium to Shaco Bottom inspired a lengthy public debate that, predictably for Richmond, ended right where it started, on the boulevard. Now, a proposed Shaco baseball move is back in the news. Today, we talk with two Richmonders who've been close to the baseball debate. Jack Berry heads Venture Richmond, and he co-authored a recent letter to the editor that has helped define this most recent conversation. But first, Charlie Diridor, a businessman and developer whose opposition 4 years ago to a Shaco move was pretty pivotal. Maybe the first question to ask is does Richmond need baseball?
Sure. Chris, thanks for having me on this morning. Richmond obviously needs baseball. We're a mid-level metropolitan area, and minor league baseball is an amenity that every city our size, every region our size needs.
It's not an amenity that every region our size has.
Certainly not, but even those that don't have it need it. Minor league baseball is a family entertainment venue these days. 3 years ago, I made the argument that the Richmond Braves model was an antiquated model, that Atlanta Braves model continues to be an antiquated model in the fact that the Braves are the only team in Major League Baseball that own all their minor league teams. That's found nowhere else in baseball. And that was a big part of why they left. The Braves, the Richmond Braves, were a player development model. And so they didn't do the things that the Squirrels do.
They Which is didn't a lot have, of family excitement.
Sure,
stuff.
Parker the pig, the raffling off a used car, professional wrestlers coming in, that kind of thing. The studies have shown, and I've been all over the country looking at minor league baseball. Basically, it comes down to this: people who go to a baseball game in Richmond come in two stripes. One stripe is it's two 35-year-old parents and two of their kids, three of their kids, out for a night of togetherness to experience something that, they'll go two or three times a year to the ball game. And it's family entertainment. And then you've got your hardcore baseball fan that'll go out there. Those parents and those kids outnumber the hardcore baseball fan, I would probably guess 3-1, 4-1. I would always argue that a metropolitan area our size does need baseball.
Now, the Sunday op-ed says that this is an economic development issue, that the time is right for Shaco Bottom and that this will spurn economic development in the bottom?
Well, Messrs. Berry and Sheeler make the argument in the op-ed piece that they wrote in Sunday's Times-Dispatch, their front page of the commentary section, which I found to be very interesting, studies show that minor league baseball stadiums are, in fact, economic drivers. I think they use that language specifically. My opportunity to take part in the debate in 2009 came along, I looked at a lot of studies, several from California, actually, that went in-depth into what does a minor league baseball stadium do for a metropolitan area. And overwhelmingly, it was stated that they are not economic drivers. And in fact, during my formal debate at the Times-Dispatch headquarters, I made the very specific argument, I'll never forget it, I made the very specific argument that minor league baseball is not an economic driver.
If it's not an economic driver, what is it? Why?
It's an amenity. It's an amenity, and that's about all it is. It's an important amenity.
What about the river?
Look, here's the answer. It's a mix between, do you want regional cooperation or do you want a baseball stadium put where the developers want the baseball stadium to go? if you want regional cooperation and you want Henrico and you want Chesterfield and you want Hanover to play in this situation, they've all indicated, especially Henrico, clearly Henrico has said that they would support a baseball stadium on the boulevard. Virgil Hazlett said that years ago, and I believe he maintains this position. If I'm correct, he gave an interview to Channel 6 right after this all blew up about a week and a half ago, and said we're still committed to a baseball stadium on the boulevard. The timing's just not right. At the opening day this year, Lou DiBella and the mayor stood together on the first baseline and on the boulevard, and Lou DiBella said quite clearly, the Richmond Flying Squirrels are the Richmond Flying Squirrels, and we are not leaving. And there was a rousing round of applause, and that was at the beginning of the season, and here we are with a month left, and we're talking about Shaco Bottom again. You asked, what about the river? I like to give direct answers to direct questions. It's fine. The river's a fine place. The Reynolds site's a great place for it. The question is this: do you have regional cooperation? And the answer is no. So the question is really one where the city leaders have to say what they mean and mean what they say. Well, they're either going to say they're either
Charlie.
Gonna say,
it sounds like what you're. Forgive me here, but you're almost contradicting what is a constant county message. And I'm not saying you're contradicting it, but you're laying out an argument that has the county contradicting itself or the counties contradicting themselves. And nobody is more vocally for highest and best use of and for business leaders, you know, not business leaders, but for businesses leading development than Henrico and Chesterfield. And yet here, when we get into the conversation about regionalism and the baseball stadium, it seems to get more mixed up. And all of a sudden, it's about the localities getting to decide, the government getting to decide where this thing is going to go. But again, you're saying that, you know, the argument here, I think that you've rather persuasively outlined it. It's, you know, the
it's one or the other, Chris.
It's the developer versus the regional governments.
I wouldn't now. Wait a minute.
In deciding where this thing is
exactly,
going to go.
Yeah. Let's qualify your statement there. It's developer versus the governments. That's
it's highest and best use from a business perspective, and highest and best use from a government perspective.
From a political perspective.
A political.
Let's just say it. Let's call it what it is.
Okay, that brings us to I think a very interesting point that's different this time. Going into this argument, and that is that you have some very significant players who are now for Shaco Bottom. Again, it seems to me, and I haven't figured this one out yet, in contradiction to the localities that they represent, but this is the Greater Richmond Chamber and the Venture Richmond have both leaders of those two organizations penned this op-ed together. Mm-hmm. And come out in support of it. So I guess the question at the end of this whole thing is, and I think Sports Backers is also backing
Sports
it.
Backers was with them in 2009 on this. In fact, in 2009, Sports Backers actually had never made themselves part of the public debate on any issue like this, and they did in 2009.
But with these various groups now coming together
sure.
for this, are you fighting a losing battle?
First of all, I'm not fighting. Again, I am advocating for the taxpayer, okay? If you want to call that fighting, so be it. What I'm saying is Venture Richmond, the Greater Richmond Chamber, any other entity that wants to voice their opinion in the affirmative for the Shaco Bottom plan, better show me or show the taxpayer how this is not going to injure the taxpayer in the long run. And I think that's important. I think that if we wait for the economy to get better, if we're careful with the dollars and cents of the taxpayers, both at the counties and at the city, eventually, and I don't mean 7 years from now, I mean 3 to 4 years from now, we'll be able to build a great baseball stadium where the county dwellers will feel comfortable coming to.
Last question, short answer, please.
Yes.
Do you think the squirrels can wait that long?
Yes.
Squirrels have short attention spans.
Not these squirrels. The head squirrel, Mr. DiBella, is a Harvard-trained lawyer. He's a boxing promoter. He understands boxing and he understands the law. And both demand patience. He understands patience.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Jack Berry of Venture Richmond co-authored with Kim Schuler of the Greater Richmond Chamber a Times-Dispatch op-ed recently that has people talking again about baseball.
Well, it just seemed like an opening for the city to take the leadership and do what's best both for the city and the region and the squirrels. We gotten indications from the counties that they were not going to be in a position to financially support the renovation or the new ballpark at the Diamond anytime in the foreseeable future due to economic conditions. Obviously, they've been hit pretty hard by the recession. And the squirrels need a new home, and it's about time that we do something about it. This is an issue that's been kicking around for 5 or 10 years. So it just seemed like to us that this was a good time for the city to step up and take the lead and do what's in this best interest of the city from an economic development standpoint, and we happen to think that that's Shaco Bottom.
Okay, so if we're burying this stadium 2 stories underground, again, we're going to have to be digging things up. What might we lose? Are we going to be rushing archaeology?
I think one of the first steps would be to bring on an archaeologist firm to evaluate what we have, because it is the oldest part of the city. There are definitely going to be things that are found there. Everything from pottery shards to arrowheads to foundations of previous buildings that were there.
And again, I guess the big controversy seems to be over the area's importance as a slave district during the 1820s to the 1860s. And its national or potential national significance in that way. So those buildings, I guess, seem to be the things that or potential building foundations that are the biggest controversy. So how do you make sure those are in some way either preserved or acknowledged or become part of this?
Yeah, the slavery resources are by far the most important and the most sensitive. And so the whole investigation has to be done with great care and a lot of conversation among various groups in the community that care deeply about these issues. It can't be something that's rushed through without regard to those important issues and resources. Now, Lumpkin's Jail, which is the most important site, I guess, along with the Negro Burial Ground, those would be, I guess, the two most important sites downtown for slavery resources.
Or the two we've identified.
Right, but the two that we know most about, I guess, both of those are west of the train trestles. They're west of the Main Street Station shed. They're up against the Interstate 95, and the ballpark doesn't go anywhere near those two sites.
So that would be to the east of any of that.
Right.
Okay.
Now there were slave auction houses throughout downtown and throughout Chaco. Again, if you look at the map that was developed a few years ago, most of those auction houses were, again, to the west of the train trestles in the 15th Street area. There were several potential auction sites that are in the area that we're looking at for the ballpark and for related facilities to serve the ballpark, including the office, residential uses, and parking. So we've got to understand those thoroughly and understand what was there when, what might be found if the site were redeveloped.
So could something that we find underground, though, disrupt moving forward with this project? Would there be a caveat? I mean, if we don't find anything, then this might be a good place? Or is this if we find something, we dig it up and quarry what is necessary to get out of there and then go forward with the project? Or
we That would be up to the archaeologist to tell us what's the best thing to do with whatever is found.
Can you make a case for why it's a good idea to put a ball diamond in the downtown area right there that is this resource for what makes Richmond historic? And so much of that, according to some of the experts, is underground still, unmined, so to speak. If you're putting a ball diamond on top of part of it, how do you weigh the good and the bad and justify that? And then also, I guess, just from an economic standpoint, what is the benefit to the ball diamond downtown?
Well, first of all, the site is pretty much vacant. It's surface parking lots and weeds. There are two significant buildings on the site. One is the Wyman's Bakery, which is half of that building is cinder block. And the other is what's left of the Loving's Produce building. Much of that has already been demolished, I think, due to a fire. So we're not talking about destroying the historic fabric of Shaco Bottom. We're not talking about tearing down block faces of historic buildings. We're talking about taking a series of surface parking lots in a very decayed part of downtown and redeveloping that into a ballpark, which would be surrounded by residential, office, and retail uses. So the ballpark would be depressed into the ground so that you would walk into the ballpark and then walk down to your seat, and thereby enabling the perimeter of the ballpark to be three-story buildings, which it matches the scale, at least, of what's on the block faces just opposite that area. So
in other words, we're not going to be looking at basically the diamond downtown.
No, that's a great big towering piece of concrete that's god-awful ugly. We're not talking about that at all. We're talking about a much smaller ballpark for starters, probably 7,500 seats, not this two-level monstrosity that we have out there. And it would be depressed into the ground. So the whole idea would to make it fit within the scale of what's there now and to finish out the block faces that are now, again, just open surface parking lots. So I think it can be done in a sensitive way. It will... I think one of the real benefits of doing it in the bottom is that it makes that part of downtown family friendly. It's a place now that attracts young families and children. Right now, Shaco Bottom is not thought of as a place where you bring children. It's thought of as a kind of a scruffy area that's making a comeback, but it's bars and restaurants, and it's sometimes crime at 2 a.m. when the bars let out. Well, creating a ballpark in that neighborhood makes it a place where families come from all over the region. So all of a sudden now they become familiar with the area. They know where to park. They know where to find a pizza after the game. It's just part of their experience of living in this region.
So I think that's a big benefit
to the bottom.
So it's not if you build it, they will come. It's if you build it, they will come downtown again is sort of where we're aiming here. It's training people back to downtown.
Yeah.
And you think that the squirrels at this point have become enough of a natural draw that they'll be able to overcome people's current fears.
Hey, if Nutsy lives down there, then it's a good place to go. Kids are going to want to be there.
Well, last question, I guess, is this. If things have changed to where the counties really aren't in a financial place to do something like this right now, why is the city, why is private industry?
Well, I think the vehicle that would be used to finance it would be tax increment financing, where you draw a boundary around a certain geographical area, and you capture the incremental taxes. So all the taxes that come because of new development stay with the project as opposed to go into the city's general fund. So that is a viable way to finance this kind of project. It's done all over the country. So with that mechanism, I think the city could allow for economic development to pay a big share of the cost of the project. Based on TIF financing.
And here you're talking businesses that come in, businesses that are already in that district as it's been done.
Real estate development that's not there now. So new real estate development that's not there now. So it's not a tax that anybody's collecting right now. It would be taxes on new projects that would come as a result of the ballpark or in close proximity to the ballpark. And instead of those taxes going to the general fund to pay for cops and schools, those taxes that we're not getting now would stay in a pot and be used to pay for ballpark-related things. Or or for neighborhood revitalization in general, which might include historic assets that we've been talking about west of the train tracks, slavery resources, historic interpretation. So this could be a project that does more than just a ballpark. It could help to revitalize Chaco, and it could help to develop historic resources as well.
Okay, so, and we're here with Jack Berry with Venture Richmond, and I think that's about all the time we have. So thank you again for coming in and talking a little bit about the ballpark and this latest iteration of a plan to bring it down to Chaco Bottom.
Thanks for having me.
All right.
He's just a man and not a freak. Jolton Jordan the Magic.
You're with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 LPFM WRIR in the topic of choice is water and how much we pay for it. This week and next, we'll be talking about Richmond's water rates, which are statistically among the highest in the nation. The Sierra Club Falls of the James and the Richmond chapter of the NAACP are among those groups speaking out about this. The Sierra Club Falls of the James has even circulated an online petition to get Richmond City Council and the Jones administration to lower the rates. As election season heats up, will H2O become a big campaign issue? Well, Charles Poole certainly hopes so. He's with the Sierra Club's Fall of the James chapter, and he's one of the citizens leading the fight to lower the rates, and he's here with me today on Open Source RVA. Thanks for coming in, Charles.
Oh, Don, thank you so much for highlighting this issue. The minimum service charge for the water and sewer rates are not even shown on the bill that people receive, so it's very important for organizations like WRIR to focus attention on this issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, next week we'll have Bob Stidell of Richmond's Department of Utilities to talk about the city's stance on this growing issue. Charles, is it true that the city of Richmond has the highest water rate in the nation?
Well, I believe it is, Don, at $49.40. We found no communities in the entire United States that have a minimum water charge that high. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of focus has been on the toll road, which everybody's up in arms about the $1 mm-hmm. monthly service charge. And the residents of Richmond aren't aware that we're paying over $49 every month just to be connected to the water system.
So $49.40, that's what everyone pays in the city before they even see a drop of water.
That's correct.
Now, how does that match up with some of the water fees from neighboring counties?
Well, interestingly enough, Henrico and Chesterfield both get water from Richmond, and they also get water treated at the waste treatment plant of Richmond. But their minimum service charge is much lower. As a matter of fact, Henrico's is only $16, and Chesterfield is $22. Hmm. So Richmond actually, although they're providing the service, the Richmond citizens are getting a much worse deal than the surrounding counties.
Hmm. Well, I've heard the argument that an older city like Richmond has aging infrastructure and sewer overflow problems, and that's why the fees are so high. Could that be true?
Well, we're talking about two ways the city gets income, through the volume charge and the service charge. Richmond's volume charge is unusually low, but the service charge that you pay, even if you don't use any amount of money, is unusually high. So what we're endorsing is a revenue neutral proposal to lower the service charge and raise the volume rate. At this point, the city is running a $12 million profit from the waterworks each year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're actually using the water and sewer utilities as a cash cow.
Right. You would think if we had an infrastructure problem, rusty pipes and whatnot, that would go into solving that problem.
Well, that's true. And if you look at some of the rates from other cities, like New York City, for example, New York City is just about a quarter of the minimum service charge of Richmond. Mm-hmm. And that kind of puts to rest the myth that Richmond's pipes are so rusty mm-hmm. that they have to have such outrageous minimum service.
Right, because you would assume that New York would also have an antiquated
system. I think they probably do. Even cities in the desert southwest, such as Phoenix, have a minimum service charge of only $5. The thing is that this is both a economic justice issue and a conservation issue, because these outrageous minimum service charges do not encourage conservation, mm-hmm. and they place an undue burden on low-income families who, by and large, they don't use as much water as a wealthy family, filling swimming pools and sprinkling large lawns and yards.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, in fact, just very recently, Salim Khalifani of the Richmond chapter of the NAACP issued a statement that said this, quote, "Typically, low-income residents will not be filling swimming pools or sprinkling massive yards. These high minimum service charges force low-income residents to subsidize wealthy households that typically use the most water." So you agree with him that this is also an economic justice
Absolutely.
Problem.
Absolutely. The NAACP is really fired up on this because it's a social justice issue. The low-income families should not be forced to pay $49 to be connected to the water system, because this is a necessity. This is the most regressive way possible to fund the city's general fund. They're keeping the minimum service charge this high, and yet they're skimming off $12 million a year as profit, which goes into the general fund.
But could these high water rates actually be kind of an offset that actually helps the city pay for city services for its poorest citizens, since the city doesn't collect enough property or other taxes, it has to make it up somehow?
Well, that goes back to the how do you raise the money? If you increase the tax on the amount of volume people used, that would be reasonable. But the city actually receives $30 million annually just from the residences of Richmond from just the service charge. So it's really not fair to Social Security grandma or a low-income family who's using practically no water. This comes out to $592 annually that these folks are having to pay just to be connected to the water supply.
You're with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 LPFM WRIR. My name is Don Harrison, and we're talking to Charles Poole, who's one of the leaders behind a campaign to lower Richmond's water rates. Some localities only charge according to what is used. They don't insist on a minimum fee. I was curious to see that my old haunts, Norfolk, Virginia, only charges $1, for instance.
Yes.
And I wonder why Richmond can't adopt that kind of
service. I think that's ideal. The Norfolk webpage says that $1 is their actual cost to provide the accounting service for each residence, and everybody who lives in Norfolk will pay a water bill which is in exact proportion to the amount of water and sewer service that they use. This is the way it should be. In Richmond, if you use 100 cubic foot of water, you will not even pay half of what someone pays for if they're using 10 units. Now, I said that backwards. Someone who's using 10 cubic feet will not pay double the amount that a person using 100 cubic feet is using.
Has Richmond always had a problem with high water rates, or is this a relatively new fee that's being charged?
Well, Don, we've been tracking this since 2007. Mm-hmm. In 2007, the city promised to reduce the minimum service charge. Matter of fact, I'm reading from an article that came out in October 2007 in the Times-Dispatch, and they said that the plan was to reduce the monthly service charge paid by residential customers by 594 cents a month. And instead, what they did over the ensuing 5 years is they actually raised by $6 the monthly service charge. So we've been tracking this, and we took the city at their word that they were going to get the service charges adjusted, but they never have actually done it.
Hmm. Now, the Sierra Club Fall of the James has an online petition that people can sign if they are so disposed. That's at virginia.sierraclub.org/FOJ. Can you summarize exactly what the petition sets out to do? What are you trying to get Richmond's leaders to do?
Well, Don, we're trying to get the minimum monthly service charge for water and sewer service reduced to $15 a month. This would be in line with other communities, and this would be fair and equitable. And it wouldn't cause such an enormous burden on low-income families. And it would actually encourage conservation because people's water and sewer bills would be more in proportion with the amount of service they're using.
Mm-hmm. There was a 2010 study by the nonprofit Circle of Blue, which showed that there's a great fluctuation in water rates across the nation, and sometimes it just doesn't make sense. Is this just one of those instances where it's just out of proportion, out of kilter?
Well, it's ironic, Don, that in Richmond, the utility is owned by the locality, owned by the city of Richmond, and therefore the rates are not reviewed by the State Corporation Commission.
Mm-hmm.
If the utility was owned by a private entity, as it is in many of the other cities which you were just mentioning, there would be some kind of review of the rates. But I think this is why Richmond's bill is so out of kilter, because it is not reviewed by any other agency.
What are some of the water rates for some of the neighboring counties? Do you have that list?
Well, I do, Don. Thank you so much. In RICO, we're talking now about the minimum monthly payment
right.
for water and
before
sewer.
Before you even see a drop of
That's
water.
That's right. In Richmond, it is $49.40. And in RICO, it is $16.27. In Chesterfield, it's $22.16. Lynchburg is interesting because Mr. Stidell, is the utility director, has mentioned that Lynchburg is a city like Richmond,
mm-hmm.
which has an aging infrastructure and
the rusty pipe,
the rusty
problem,
pipe yeah. problem. He mentioned this as a comparable city, but interestingly enough, Lynchburg's minimum monthly service charge is only $3.69.
Hmm.
So I don't know how Richmond's minimum service charge got to be so high. I think one reason, as I mentioned before, it's not shown on the bill,
mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
that very few people realize just how exorbitant it is.
I think you said something earlier before we started that this has actually been, the Richmond has had a relatively high rate since the 90s.
I think in the 90s when they started the sewer overflow project, I think that's when it first started to escalate. Many people thought at that time that this was going to be a temporary service charge increase.
Right.
And of course, the city, once it makes an increase, they very rarely want to decrease it.
Right, right. Well, thanks so much for coming in today, Charles, and talking about this. We've been talking to Charles Poole. He's with the Sierra Club's Falls of the James chapter, and we've been talking water rates.
Well, thank you so much, Don. Again, if people want to go to that change.org and put their name on the petition, I think that will have an impact.
And that petition is also available on the Sierra Club Falls of the James website as well. You are with Open Source RVA here on 97.3 LPFM WRIR. My name is Don Harrison.
And that's Open Source RVA for Friday, August 17th, 2012. I'm Chris Dovey, and my hosts are Don Harrison and Amy Daniel. Our producer is Jay Westerman, and our board op is Rachel Solomon. We'll meet you here next week for part two of our look at the city's water rates, and we're already working on other stories that are making headlines, or that should be. And we want to hear from you. Email us with your story ideas, comments, and news tips at opensourcerva@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook at Open Source RVA and follow us on Twitter at RVA Open Source. Thanks. Have a good weekend.